This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Katrina, now a tropical depression, is moving north and east, bringing heavy rain and wind to Tennessee, Kentucky, Indiana, and Ohio today. As Hurricane Katrina, it left a wide swath of extraordinary damage yesterday along the Gulf Coast, and it's blamed for at least 68 deaths, 55 of them in Mississippi. Those numbers could rise. The White House said today that President Bush will cut short his vacation and return to Washington tomorrow to monitor federal assistance, and an enormous amount of assistance is needed on all levels. Rescue workers in Louisiana, Alabama, and Mississippi are still working to pull victims away from floodwaters, debris, and stranded homes. In places, looting is underway, and many thousands of people are wondering about family and friends, about their homes, and what they'll find when they finally do get back to their houses. Today on Talk of the Nation, the day after. Communications in the worst-hit areas are still very poor. Phone lines and power are out in a wide area, and people are understandably reluctant to use precious cell phone batteries for anything less than an emergency. But we do want to hear your stories of Katrina. What happened? How did you deal with it? Did preparations work? Later in the program, we'll talk about long-term proposals to preserve the city of New Orleans, which lies below sea level, including new and higher levees and even walls around downtown, and restoration of wetlands that could absorb much of the storm surges that caused so much of the flooding. Right now, if you have stories or questions about Hurricane Katrina, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's start in New Orleans. Joshua Clark is founder and editor of the Light of New Orleans publishing firm in the heart of the French Quarter. He wrote out Hurricane Ivan last year. And he ignored the evacuation order and rode out Katrina with his girlfriend this year. He joins us now from his apartment in the French Quarter. Nice of you to join us on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil.
Once the 140-mile-an-hour winds hit, I wondered, did you rethink your decision to stay?
It was frightening, but no. I'm in a building here that surrounds Jackson Square. I don't know how much that means to everybody, but it's one of the oldest apartment buildings in the country. Actually, it is the oldest. It's been there 160 years. It's seen 160 years of hurricanes, and it's sort of built like a fortress. It literally takes up an entire city block, and I'm on the third floor. You know, I expected it to be worse than it was, frankly.
And but tell us, what did it look like? What did it sound like?
It sounded like a woman screaming, trying to get in my front door. That and a combination of the wind was basically whistling, screeching, this shrill screaming coming in the windows and then the front door, the entryway anyway, and back and forth. So it's like an inhaling, exhaling. And then it got to the point where it was just like the end of a horror film. It was going, and everything's rattling, of course. And you know, every once in a while, I'd peek outside and see literally tornadoes of rain going around and around and signs flying and everything.
And much of the time when it was actually the worst, it's dark out there.
Correct.
Yeah, it's pretty scary.
Yeah, it was. It was very scary. It was very scary hearing the immensity, just feeling the immensity. The building was not shaking, but you could feel the pressure in the air. You feel it in your ears. You feel it in your head, your stomach, everything. And it's dark out there, and you know it. You haven't even felt the full force of it yet, because I don't think the full force hit until about, oh, I don't know, was it 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock in the morning?
Mm-hmm.
So... yeah,
I understand you didn't really get out of your house until about noon today.
No, noon yesterday.
Noon yesterday, excuse me.
Noon yesterday, yeah. So, yeah. We're getting a little confused with the days, too, here.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Yeah, we went out when it was still gusty and there was still lots of rains and things were getting blown around a bit, but there was no flying debris and we could certainly stand okay. We put our slickers on. We were some of the first people out. And we walk outside, standing right by my entryway. It's just some old homeless guy with a cane standing there asking us if we have a cigarette. You know, that's New Orleans for you. He's just standing there in the middle of the rain.
So how many people, were there people around?
People slowly started to emerge. More and more we saw people emerging with cocktails in their hands. And this is the French Quarter, you know. Our bars are 24 hours and stuff. And we found one bar that didn't close down. We found another bar that didn't close down. They just refused to close down. The patrons stayed inside. They put the plywood outside. They put up signs like, "We will not die sober," things like that. More and more people, when the light came out and the rain stopped, they just kept coming out and surveying the damage. And, you know, overall, I got to tell you, in the court, this is a very serious disaster. No one is taking it lightly, but we are very fortunate. We're the highest ground here. We received no flooding. Roofs got torn off. Roof flashing in particular was all over the streets and bent around parking signs. I mean, just like spaghetti. It was immense. But very minimal destruction to people's homes here in the French Quarter.
Have you managed to get to other parts of the city?
Yeah, we went all through the Central Business District. Some of it looks like the apocalypse has hit. I mean, brick buildings, bricks on top of cars, whole parking lots with all the windows and the cars have been blown out because of the pressure and stuff, and glass just all over some of our widest avenues. I mean, just coated with it because apparently the whole south side of the Hyatt got blown out. The top flew off the Superdome and blew into the Hyatt and blew all the glass out there, and so, yeah, a lot of glass everywhere. We headed uptown yesterday to where my girlfriend Ellen lives, and it was just, it looked like a rainforest. All the trees are down everywhere. You know, and amongst the trees, of course, are wires that are down that no one wants to get near.
Do you have power?
We do not. No, we lost power. All the clocks here say about 6:25 in the morning. So it was yesterday at 6:25 in the morning that we lost power.
Mm-hmm. Now, oddly, many of us out long way away from New Orleans may have seen more pictures of the damage than you have. Obviously, you've seen it close up, though.
Correct. Yeah, we're depending on other people calling, and as you know, I mean, the lines are down. None of the cell phones are working. This is a landline, and people have been able to reach us, and we're hearing stories from other people. We only have one radio station working, and it's broadcasting on all the frequencies, basically, that we can find FM. And what it is reports from different people in town calling in and different city officials, but we're getting very little of, like, the bigger picture. You know, we're hearing direct reports of, yes, there's flooding in this section, flooding in this section, but no, we're not seeing pictures. So
what is working?
I'm sorry?
What is working?
Well, the water is working, which is the most important thing. You know, we can flush our toilets. We can take showers and everything. We can, you know, I have water filters, so I can drink the water and stuff.
Yeah. So you don't have to boil it or anything.
Correct. I'm lucky I don't have to do that. Hopefully people stocked up on water beforehand. You know, you're told to fill your bathtub. You know, we way overstocked. You know, I have enough water to last us 2 months if it need be. So,
So you're pretty well stocked there.
Yeah, we're doing okay. We've spent the last couple of days eating everything that's, you know, in your freezer that you want to eat and that's perishable, like salmon and shrimp and gumbo and tilapia, you name it. Like, we've been feasting on it, you know. So we've been doing okay here, yeah.
We've seen reports that there has been looting in some areas. Have you seen any evidence of that?
Yeah, we unfortunately, one of the first things we went outside, there's a restaurant below me that's right on Jackson Square, and someone had broken underneath the plywood through one of the main doors and ran in there and everything just before we had gotten there, I guess. There was a daiquiri shop. You know, we sell daiquiris to go here, and there was one right down the corner, and they just had glass doors. It looks like they didn't even board it up. All the doors are just blown out all over the street, so the whole place is just blown to hell. And they had, you know, patrons had stapled dollar bills up behind the bar and stuff, and there was just a lot of things to take. But the cops were very good. As soon as it was safe, they were out and around. They were assessing the damage. They were assessing these places that had been looted and getting people out of there. There's a big grocery store, Winn-Dixie, that's just outside of the French Quarter, apparently, that they started looting immediately when the storm let up, but the cops took care of it very quickly. And we saw all last night they were patrolling all these areas and all these businesses that were vulnerable.
Now, how long is it going to be, do you think, before your neighbors start to return and the place starts to come back to life?
You know, no one's thinking about returning right now, I'll tell you. We've been getting calls all day, and we're hearing this morning reports about 4 weeks of no electricity, even here in the French Quarter. So if that's the case, you know, we'll have to get out of here, which is ironic, leaving after the hurricane. And we hear about the flooding getting worse, not better. And as of this morning, apparently they couldn't figure out where exactly the water was coming from. You know, the city's surrounded by levees. The city, of course, is anywhere from 6 to 20 feet under sea level. You know, we have levees, basically, but it's the only thing keeping us from being drowned. And it's not good when a hurricane hits them. You have breaches in the levee.
Well, obviously a lot of long-term questions to be answered.
Yeah.
Congratulations for writing it out, and good luck to you.
Neil, I'll tell you one thing. I mean, this city arguably has seen more disaster than any other city. I mean, for 300 years, we've faced fires and floods and plagues and yellow fever, you name it, and we've seen it. And this is very serious, and it took us a while to get over, but we will get over it. I mean, you know, against all odds, we've been living below sea level for this long, so we're going to keep going.
Joshua Clark. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Neil.
Joshua Clark, editor of The Light of New Orleans Publishing in the French Quarter, and he joined us from his apartment in New Orleans. To get a better sense of the scene in Louisiana, we turn now to Joe Contreras. He's a reporter for Newsweek magazine. He's been covering the storm, and he joins us now by cell phone. Where are you exactly, Joe?
I'm in Breaux Bridge, Louisiana, west of the state capital of Baton Rouge.
And what have you been seeing as you've been moving around?
Well, yesterday afternoon, I drove into the New Orleans metropolitan area and got as far east as the suburb of Metairie, which lies adjacent to the city limits. There I saw about two dozen evacuees who had fled the city over the weekend, only to return with a certain hopefulness yesterday afternoon after they heard that Katrina had dealt New Orleans apparently a glancing blow and was headed on to the Mississippi Gulf Coast. But when they arrived, of course, they found their suburb, Metairie, already knee-deep in water, and their passage to their homes completely blocked. And then this morning and yesterday evening, I've been touring around Louisiana and seeing all the various hotels completely chock-a-block with refugees and shelters being set up around the state to house those people without a hotel room or those people who are fleeing New Orleans now that the hurricane has ended.
Refugees, that conjures up an awful picture.
It does, and I use the term advisedly. I have spent 16 years as a foreign correspondent for Newsweek magazine. I'm now based in Miami, but continue to work in Latin America primarily. And the scenes that I have witnessed in the past 36 hours call to mind the kinds of imagery of Parisians fleeing Paris as the Nazis advance, in the sense of people who are middle class or upper middle class in circumstance being reduced to the status of displaced persons.
Can you stay on the line with us just for a second, Joe? We have to take a short break.
Sure.
All right. Joe Contreras of Newsweek magazine. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with him and begin to take your calls. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. It's the day after Katrina. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. When Katrina came ashore from the Gulf of Mexico on Monday, winds were more than 135 miles an hour. Heavy rain and storm surges combined with the winds to cause billions of dollars in damage as the then hurricane hit New Orleans, Gulfport, Biloxi, Mississippi, and extended well into Alabama. Power and telephone lines are down all over the region. We'd like to hear from you if you're available, if your phone works, if your computer works. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, totn@npr.org. Right now we're speaking with Joe Contreras of Newsweek magazine, who's in Metairie, Louisiana. And that's I wanted to ask you, Joe, do we know if authorities have been able to control looting? And we're hearing about more flooding.
Yes, I'm hearing those same reports. Apparently, there were breaches at two junctures of the levee that your previous guest was discussing. I've heard a report of two breaches in the levee and that helicopters are attempting to lower 3,000-pound sandbags to block the breaches, but until they somehow manage to remedy that situation, you're talking about a gargantuan volume of Mississippi River water that is pouring in, not just the swelling of the river and Lake Pontchartrain from Hurricane Katrina, but the natural normal amount of water that goes through the Mississippi River, and that seems to be causing the relentless rise of the floodwaters.
Mm-hmm. Now, as you look at the situation, obviously you've not been able to get into New Orleans itself, but, well, you heard our previous guest, and I guess you've got some impression as well. This is going to be weeks, months, years.
Well, it will certainly be, I think, weeks, as, again, your previous guest was suggesting, before power is restored, before running water once again flows. It will be months, I think, before the city gains a semblance of normalcy. And, of course, New Orleans is hardly a normal place for those of us who have the privilege of visiting the city. And it'll be years before I think they'll ever come to grips with a new contingency plan to cope with the kind of biblical emergency now facing the city and its residents.
Well, we'll have more on that later in the program. But Joe Contreras, thanks very much for taking the time to speak with us, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
Joe Contreras, a reporter for Newsweek. He's been covering Hurricane Katrina from Louisiana, and he joined us there by his cell phone. Let's get some callers on the line. 800-989-8255. Email is totn@npr.org. We'll begin with Donna. Donna calling us from Watertown, Tennessee.
Hello.
Hi, Donna. You're on the air.
Hi. Mostly, I just want to, I'm begging for information for the small towns like Pascagoula, O'Shea, Ocean Springs, Mississippi. That's where most of the water, well, I don't even know if I can say most of the water is there. I've heard rumors. My mother's down there. She couldn't get in touch with us until this morning. And nobody's reporting on anything except for New Orleans, and then they skip clean over to Mobile, Alabama.
Donna, let me just, from our perspective, we've been trying to reach people in that area of Mississippi all day. Believe me, communications are really poor.
Right. All the towers go down first, I'm sure. Some of the cell phones are working because my mother finally, with a long line of people and one guy and his cell phone, she was able to call and say, I'm alive, and that she had knee-deep water. She believed that Pascagoula only had 3 feet of water, and I informed her that I heard that Beach Boulevard, where, by the way, Trent Lott's house is, was underwater.
Well, we'll try to do our best. All we can promise you is if you stay tuned to us, we'll do our best to get you the news as soon as we can.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much for the call, Donna. In fact, we can begin maybe now. Joining us now is from Mississippi's Emergency Management Agency is spokeswoman Lee Stokes. She's in Jackson, Mississippi, and it's nice of you to be with us today.
Thank you for having me, and I feel the same way as your caller. We are all having a hard time trying to get exact information on communities. I do know about the Jackson County area. There was one community that seems to be devastated. I know there's flooding, and I know things like the Pascagoula Police Department had a lot of vehicles they lost underwater. I know MEMA and some MEMA personnel lost our own vehicles. They were under a lot of water. But as far as each exact community of Ocean Springs and Goshen and Pascagoula and Moss Point, which I grew up just north of there, I know very well, I can't even find information out. We're trying very hard to get that information for people.
And what's NEMA?
MEMA, a Mississippi Emergency Management Agency.
Okay. As I understand it, you've been getting help from other states and communities in the area.
Yes. In our nation, we have the Emergency Management Assistance Compact. It's 48 states, and we have emergency management personnel from Florida, Georgia, Kentucky, several states volunteering to come over and help in this area. They're in our EOC. We have some going forward. All of our state agencies, we had positioned some people on the coast and in some counties before Katrina hit. So we do have some satellite communication with them. Very, very little phone communication, like your caller said, in some areas. Some people are able to get through. We were being inundated with people calling, wanting to know about their family members, and we still are, but at least we know that some people know that their family members are alive. And I can tell you that, you know, we have about 13,000 people in Red Cross shelters in Mississippi right now. So there are several people on the coast who are still in shelters, and I know their family members who are not on the coast are concerned about them. But, you know, the Red Cross is trying to coordinate a way so they can be in contact with them and know they're okay.
We have heard estimates of the number of dead and confirmed numbers, I think 55 just in Jackson County. Isn't that right?
No, for the state, we've confirmed 7 dead, but none of those are from the Gulf Coast. We don't have any kind of confirmed numbers, and we are confirming numbers only when they come from a coroner's report. There are coroners and additional coroners in the area to help do this, and until we get confirmed numbers, we're not giving guesstimates out.
Probably a wise decision. Can you take some calls with us?
Sure, love to.
Let's talk with Katie. Katie's calling us from Kalamazoo in Michigan.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Well, I'm a little worried. My grandmother, she lives in a retirement community in Ocean Springs, Mississippi, And my uncle lives down there as well, and apparently she was supposed to be with him during the hurricane. However, he was being very stubborn and was determined to stay home and ride this thing out. She's almost 90 years old, and I just have this vision of her on top of their one-story house with flood waters all around them, and, you know, it's a little scary.
I wish I had better news, Katie. Stay in contact with the Red Cross. Their toll-free number is 866-GET-INFO.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Because it's quite possible they did leave at the last minute and go to a nearby shelter.
Geez, I hope so.
I mean, that is quite possible, and don't give up hope. And there's always, you know, the event where people come out fine and unscathed.
Oh, well, I hope so.
We're starting water. We're trying to locate locations now for water and ice distribution points and to get feeding canteens from the Salvation Army in. You know, so
okay.
if there's any way possible, we're trying to let you get contact with them.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Good luck, Katie.
Thanks.
And now let's go to Jeff. Jeff is calling us from Jacksonville in Florida.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello, Jeff.
Hi. We actually evacuated on Sunday. We have a caravan of five families, our family, from Biloxi, Long Beach, past Christiane. And I'm a little frustrated. We're actually headed back from Jacksonville now toward Mississippi because we can't get any information on what's going on in Pass Christian, Long Beach, Bay St. Louis, which is where our homes are. You know, we've been watching the news for 2 days, and no one is reporting on those three communities, and we don't know why. So it's very frustrating. We're headed back that way, get as close as we can.
Yes, and I'm sorry. We've tried desperately to get the word out, and even in Jackson with power outages, we've had email out. I can tell you they are not letting people back into the Gulf Coast area, Jeff, and it's probably going to be a few days. And they are keeping a curfew in effect, and that's because we are rapidly doing search and rescue missions in all areas.
We understand that. It's just, you know, they've been doing helicopter flyovers of, you know, the bigger cities, Biloxi, Gulfport, but they don't even mention the little towns. You know,
I agree completely, and we have plenty of citizens calling in, and I'm telling them, you know, call the national media and tell them. I guess the national media is worried with the casino area, of course. But lots of wonderful and beautiful communities in Hancock and Jackson County are really being overlooked. And, you know, I know that Stennis Space Center was okay. They did have some damage to buildings, but they had 2,400 people in shelters there. Those people seem to be okay. But most of Highway 90 and Interstate 10 of Hancock County are washed away or under sand or water. Just the roads are not cleared at all.
Well, would you advise Jeff to try to come back?
No, absolutely not. We are asking people to stay out of the way of emergency workers. They're literally taking chainsaws and trying to get into different communities and to see who's there and who needs help.
And for one thing, Jeff, I think we're hearing about enormously long lines for what little gasoline is available in the region.
Well, it's nothing like on the way out, or probably just like on the way out. That was incredible in itself.
Yeah.
I'm just glad you and your family and your friends, your caravan got out. You know, thank God.
Yeah. Well, you know, if someone can report on the littler towns between Gulfport and New Orleans, we'd sure appreciate it.
We're trying to get everything we can out, and we need the national media's help. We need them to do some flyovers and show some scenes for people to see.
Jeff, good luck.
Sending someone in there. Thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye. Let's take one more call here. This is David. David's calling from Bucks County in Pennsylvania.
Yes, hi. How are you?
Very well.
I was going to say the caller that worked with Newsweek there, he didn't quite pronounce it right. It's Metairie. The locals pronounce it Metairie.
Okay.
But your guest there from NEMA and the caller from the Pass Christian area, they're hitting it right on the head. It's shocking, surprising that the news media, all the national and international media, couldn't tell where they should be to be able to report what was going to happen there come Saturday evening. You know, just watching the weather and realizing that hurricane was probably going to come straight north somewhere between New Orleans and Mobile, that's why there's so much consternation. There's no media there. I-10 access going east is out from New Orleans. They all went to New Orleans. Amazing.
Absolutely right, and all we need are people to tell the national media we've got to focus. Hancock County was probably the hardest hit county, and it's the county that borders Louisiana. And we're, you know, national media, you're getting almost no airplay or anything on those communities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's no media there. And if they had been, they'd have satellite hookup and you'd have the information. That place is totally underwater.
To be fair, I think until just about the last minute, everybody thought the storm was going a little bit further west than it turned out to go.
Well, I think what I saw come Saturday night, I mean, my background is basically private pilot weather knowledge, but I could see come Saturday evening about midnight that it was pretty obvious in the northeast corner, that storm is always the worst.
Yeah, so, that's true enough. David, thanks very much.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye. And Lee Stokes, we know you're very busy. We appreciate you taking the time to speak with us today. Hello, Lee?
I'm sorry, yes.
I was just saying thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
All right, good luck to you. Lee Stokes, a spokeswoman for the Mississippi Emergency Management Agency, and she joined us from her office in Jackson. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. On Monday, the storm traveled northeast up through Mississippi and Alabama. In its path, the city of Mobile. Joining us now to describe the situation there is Frances Coleman, editorial page editor of the Mobile Register. She's with us by phone from her office, and good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon to you, too.
And how bad was it in Mobile?
Well, it can't compare to the devastation west of here, but if you were dropped in Mobile and didn't know something, you know, particularly what had happened, you would know something had happened. It's still recovering. Our schools are still closed and probably will be all week. We have an oil rig that floated up the river and jammed under one of our bridges. We've got mud all over the streets downtown because they flooded yesterday during the storm. Now, all the floodwaters have receded, and we've got people, most of us have got people in our living rooms, bedrooms, and dens who have refugeed here from Louisiana and Mississippi. I've got some college kids at our house waiting to see when they can go home.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting, I'll say that, and it's hot. I'm sitting here in the dark in our newspaper building with generator power. We've got computers and a few fans, and that's it.
Mm-hmm. So most of the city doesn't have power, I assume?
Yes, most of it, although probably as we speak, a good bit is coming back online.
Mm-hmm. You're in your office right now. What can you see out your window?
Well, I'm on the third floor, and we're near the port and near the river, so we can, if you look up the river, you can see that oil rig that's stuck up under the bridge. You can see that the dock sustained a certain amount of damage. You can see people's yards that are littered with tree limbs and, in some cases, trees. But you can see people moving around. As I say, nothing so debilitating as it is over on the Mississippi coast,
mm-hmm.
where a lot of our relatives and families live.
And obviously people are concerned. I assume you're having the same difficulty we all are in terms of getting through to those places.
Yes, I was listening to the caller and listening to the lady from Mississippi's Emergency Management, and it's the same thing. I tried to reach one of my staff writers who had family in Mississippi and who called me last night to mm-hmm. say, I got to take the day off. I got to go help my grandma, and gave me a phone number. And, of course, I can't get through to him. So in defense of the media, I'm sure if they could get into those communities, they would be there. But you can't get in, or if you're in, you can't phone out or receive telephone calls much. So the frustration, is, you know, people over here are quite anxious to hear soon the status of those communities over there.
Frances Coleman, thanks very much. Good luck.
Okay, thanks.
Frances Coleman, editorial page editor for the Mobile Register. She joined us by phone from her office in Mobile, Alabama. Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Karen. Karen's calling us from Miami in Florida.
Hi. I'm listening to all of your callers, and I can greatly sympathize as I was in Hurricane Andrew. I had my house fall down around me in Hurricane Andrew, and I felt all of that frustration. I lived in a small community that wasn't in Homestead or in Country Walk or any of the areas that got the publicity, too. So it just doesn't matter in the long run. Once I know everyone is concerned to find out if their family members are okay and how their house is. We had Katrina come through Miami unexpectedly on Thursday, and we all suffered landscape damage. We had trees blocking streets. Schools have just gone back today, and still most of my area is without power, although I do have power.
Yeah, we forget that that first pass through Florida, even then as a Category 1 hurricane, Katrina did quite a bit of damage.
Yeah, we had it over us for 6 hours, just beating us. But as a Hurricane Andrew survivor, when I listen to these comments, it just takes a lot of patience and a lot of faith that things will turn out all right. Things are not going to resolve quickly for these people. There's just limited resources, and I hope the people who have a solid roof over their head can be patient and offer shelter, as the lady said, to have people in your home.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of thing. And my mother...
Karen, I'm afraid we're running out of time, but thank you very much for the call. When we come back from a short break, we'll take a longer view at the idea of defending New Orleans. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're going to continue now our look at the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. Reuters News Service reports the death toll has risen to at least 80. Rescuers are scouring parts of Mississippi, Alabama, and Louisiana, especially to try to locate survivors, some of whom are being plucked from their roofs and by helicopters. As bad as it was in New Orleans, it could have been much worse. There are proposals to defend that city against the wind, rain, and floods certain to come with future storms. Are there natural defenses against hurricane damage? What are your ideas? 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is totn@npr.org. Joining us now is Denise Reed, a professor of geology at the University of New Orleans. She joins us now by phone from her home in Montegut. Is that right?
That's right, Montague. It's about 50, 60 miles southwest of New Orleans.
And how are you bearing there?
Well, we don't have any power, and we have a lot of downed trees, but we're really doing very well.
Let me ask you, you're an expert on the idea of the wetlands, which have been so encroached upon by development these last few decades, that those are crucial to helping this whole area survive the impact of hurricanes.
Yes, if you think about New Orleans historically, perhaps earlier in the 20th century, it would have been surrounded by vast areas of wetlands, marshes, swamps and barrier islands. A lot of that has deteriorated. We've lost 1,500 square miles of land of that kind in southeast Louisiana, and it just means that New Orleans is hanging out there a lot more than it used to be.
Mm-hmm. And what is the effect of wetlands on a storm like Katrina?
Well, a storm like Katrina, of course, is a formidable force of nature. Certainly for lesser storms that we've looked at in the past, Hurricane Andrew, for instance, that many of us remember,
mm-hmm.
You can see that, and computer models can also show us this, that as the storm surge moves through these marshes, it slows it down, and it means it doesn't get as high as quickly. And that gives more time for people to evacuate, but it also means that a levee might survive instead of being breached or overtopped. And so we've done studies that show that if we restore wetlands and barrier islands in coastal Louisiana, for some storm conditions, we could reduce the storm surge by several feet. And that could make a big difference.
Could make an enormous difference. You mentioned Hurricane Andrew took sort of the same track as Katrina did, coming through Miami and then making that northward turn and up to the Gulf Coast.
That's right. That's right. That was in 1992. It actually made landfall further to the west than Katrina, and New Orleans didn't really feel much of an impact of it. But we did see the effect of Andrew in the marshes and on the barrier islands in the system.
And how does it affect them?
Well, it's interesting. When you think about these, the whole of southeast Louisiana has been built by the Mississippi River over the last several thousand years, and hurricanes are a natural part of the landscape dynamic. And so hurricanes erode the barrier islands. I mean, we've all seen pictures of that on the TV, and we all remember that from Ivan last year in Pensacola. They redistribute the sandy beaches, but in the marshes, they can actually bring up a whole lot of mud and deposit it in the marshes that helps those marshes keep their head above sea level rise and above subsidence. So they kind of erode the edge, but they build up the middle.
Mm-hmm. Has Louisiana made any headway in efforts to restore these marshes and barrier islands?
Well, we're trying as hard as we can. We've had a federal program in place since 1990, and we've got a lot of projects. A lot of barrier island projects have been built under that. But we realize that even though we've spent $50 million a year for more than 10 years, that's just not enough. So now we've developed much more ambitious plans about what we need to do to restore the coast, and by restoring the coast, help protect some of our coastal communities.
When you say more ambitious plans, what are you talking about?
Well, much more ambitious in cost, of the order of, say, $10 billion in total. But much more ambitious in scale as well. I think in the early years of restoration here, for the most part, we were playing defense, trying to hang on to the marshes and barrier islands that we had left. We realized about 5 years into that effort in the mid-1990s that that really wasn't going to be good enough. We weren't going to get back anything of what we'd lost if we didn't start playing offense. And that means actually building up some marshes, building up dirt and getting that marsh grass to grow again in places where it's gone.
Let's get a caller in on the conversation. This is Sean. Sean calling us from here in Washington, D.C.
Hi, how you doing?
Okay.
You know, one of the things I'm thinking a lot of people missing, and this is not in the way of being unsympathetic toward the victims of this flood. You know, the government has to step in and provide and create disincentives for developing property in floodplains. This is happening all over the country. I mean, New Orleans is just an extreme of the example.
Would you agree with that, Denise Reed?
Yes, I absolutely would. We have obviously some really historic places like New Orleans that have been there a long time. And for the most part, in coastal Louisiana, we're not losing wetlands because we're building on them, because we're turning them into subdivisions or anything like that. We're actually losing them to the Gulf of Mexico. And surprisingly enough, we have very little real development of wetlands in Louisiana. And every time a storm comes through, people move further inland. And so I think those disincentives are very important, Sean, and can make a lot of difference in many areas of the country. Here, I think our problem's a little bit different, but to be sure, we don't need any more development down here, any more things to protect. We're just trying to hang on and protect to what we have.
One of the things is that it seems like this becomes an endless cycle in which these disasters perennially occur, and then people expect the government and all these other agencies to come in and correct problems that they should have been smart enough to at least try to avoid. I realize some people don't have a choice, but to allow development to build where you've had historic problems to me seems a little ridiculous.
Sean, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Denise Reed, does an event like this, as terrible as it is, does it give you, in a sense, the silver lining is that it might bring more attention to solutions like the wetlands expansion?
Yeah, I don't know if that's going to be, we'd call that a silver lining, because things seem pretty bad down here at the moment. But, there are lessons that we can learn from this from all kind of angles. And actually being strategic in our restoration efforts is really important. And it may mean that we do some kind of restoration before we do others, because it can provide us that additional benefit. I want to emphasize here that when we do restoration, it's not just when we restore our wetlands and our barrier islands. It's not just for flood protection. There are all kinds of other things that we get out of that system, like fisheries and just the natural ecosystem that we're losing very rapidly down here. So what we can do here to protect New Orleans is we can build the levees higher and higher and higher, or we can keep the levees reasonably high and we can build back the ecosystem in front of them. And it seems to many of us that if we can keep the city of New Orleans and the great character that it has and have the ecosystem back, then that's the win-win.
Denise Reed, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Denise Reed, a professor of geology at the University of New Orleans, and she joined us by phone from her home in Montague, Louisiana. Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Nathan. Nathan calling us from Concord, New Hampshire. Concord, North Carolina, excuse me.
Concord, North Carolina. excuse me, I'm sorry. I'm going to visit a friend of mine. I lived in New Orleans for 4 years now, and one of the hardest things for me to do was to leave. I packed the car up. I got my puppy. He's in the back seat. Got all my stuff, and I went back into my house 5 times to make sure, like, there's nothing else that I need, because I knew I wasn't coming back, you know, and it's one of the hardest things. I love New Orleans. I love that city. You know, it's one of the most amazing cities I've ever lived in, and to leave and to know what was going to happen, it's hard, you know. It's not easy.
When did you leave?
I left Sunday at 12 o'clock. It took me 10 hours to get from New Orleans to a small town called Troy, Alabama. It's probably like central Alabama or so.
Mm-hmm.
It took me 2.5 hours to get to the eastern side of New Orleans, which is only normally a 15-minute trip.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did you? We've been told about enormous gas lines. Well, I guess certainly beginning Sunday.
Yeah, the night before I left, about 3 in the morning, I went to the gas station. I filled up, so I didn't really have that to deal with. I just was able to talk to a friend of mine back there from the city today. You know, she has a non-504 area code number, so I was able to get through.
Mm-hmm.
Most of my friends fortunately left, and they're scattered around. They're in Atlanta, they're in Arkansas, Tennessee, Texas. A few of them said they're not coming back.
At this point, yeah. When do you think you might be able to come back?
I think I'm going to stay in Raleigh for about a week or so. I'm hoping to go back sometime next week just to kind of put some closure to it. My biggest fear right now, I'm not really worried about flooding. I can always get new carpet, new furniture. My fear is that I'll go home and there's a tree in the middle of my house. You know what I mean? That's my biggest fear. That's my biggest concern.
So you've reached some friends, but not necessarily any neighbors that can tell you what happened to your house.
No neighbors, nothing. I was hoping when you had that gentleman on earlier who was in the French Quarter, that publisher, he said he went uptown. I live uptown, Magazine in Jefferson in the city, and I was hoping he would mention that or somewhere close to it or something, you know.
Yeah.
But it's tough. That's one of the hardest parts, too, not really knowing what you're going to come back to.
Indeed. Nathan, good luck.
Thank you very much.
All right. Let's go now to Fred. Fred calling us from Westport in Connecticut.
Hi, Neil. Just wanted to comment on the earlier caller who was talking, or the guest you had talking about restoration. And
mm-hmm.
People in New Orleans, I mean, I'm sure they don't want to hear this right now, but I mean, the fact of the matter is that the New Orleans is in the Mississippi Delta. The entire Delta is fluid. I mean, you can build a city, you can draw the Mississippi River on a map and think these things are permanent, but Lake Pontchartrain is not permanent. The shoreline is not permanent. The Mississippi River wants to move. I mean, the Army Corps of Engineers has been preventing it from shifting west at Dacha Playa Basin, and the only way that the city can stay with its boundaries, with the lakeshore where it is now, is with massive investment into continuing the levees, but it's all at a cost because the whole delta is fluid and it's in constant motion, and it's this trying to impose this permanent city on it that causes this problem.
Well, I think people are reevaluating those costs even as we speak, Fred.
Sure, but nobody's going to want to relocate the city or let the river move as naturally as it would like to. They're going to want, because you have all this infrastructure, you have the shipping ports, the oil ports. So how do you reconcile that, a river that wants to move with a society that requires, we can't just pick up and rebuild the city every time that the river floods or a hurricane comes in. So mm-hmm. how do you reconcile that?
The questions that are going to be asked, we'll try to ask some of them tomorrow, but they're going to be asked for days now. Fred, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
We're talking about the Katrina the day after, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. For those trying to contact family members in Harrison County, Mississippi, it has been, as we've heard, a frustrating day. Chuck Yarbrough of Columbus, Mississippi, recently found out that his parents survived the hurricane in their home in Pas Cristan in Mississippi. He joins us now by phone from his home in Columbus, Mississippi. Nice of you to be with us today.
Well, thank you, Neil.
And I know you've been trying to contact your parents by phone and email all day. How did you finally get through?
Well, actually, I haven't spoken with them. My brother-in-law from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, had to drive over and got within about a mile of their house, and then climbing over down trees and under power lines, made it to their home, and they are okay.
That's good news, obviously.
Obviously.
do you know where they are? Is their house okay? That sort of detail?
Their house is okay. Their house is about a block and a half from the beach in Pas Cristan, Mississippi, and Pas Cristan and Bay St. Louis and Waveland, Mississippi, are three historic communities that were hammered 35 years ago by Hurricane Camille. And people, I think, like my parents, who were there in the same house, in fact, for Hurricane Camille, and weathered a 23-foot storm surge then and 175-mile-per-hour winds, I think they underestimated this storm. And I did find from my brother-in-law that they had waist-deep water in their home, which suggests to me that the storm surge for Katrina must have been about 10 feet higher than Camille.
Mm-hmm. Camille, that's the storm I guess everybody measures every other storm against in that part of the country.
It most certainly is. Camille is the benchmark. Growing up on the Gulf Coast, you know, people, the old-timers talked about Camille, and they measured it against a storm, the 47 hurricane and a hurricane called Audrey in the early 50s. And, you know, and people like my father, who is a Okinawa veteran, you know, Marine Corps kind of guy and stubborn as an Army mule, he and many, many others felt that it couldn't possibly be as bad as Camille, and apparently it was worse.
Mm-hmm. Was there talk of evacuation of those communities like Pas Cristan before the storm hit?
There was. There was a great effort. In fact, here in Mississippi, the Mississippi Public Broadcasting System went to straight talk and news and weather advisory, evacuation route advisory, about 48 hours before the storm hit. And at least on once an hour, there were state officials of one kind or another encouraging people to leave. And like I said, I think that the people who stayed, many of whom were veterans of Camille, probably just underestimated the storm.
You're in Columbus, Mississippi. What's it like there?
Well, we're about 180, 200 miles north of the coastline, and we had the storm, or it was still a hurricane when it got here, which is nearly unheard of, come through last night around 10 o'clock or so. And there are a lot of people in this county, which is Lowndes County, with the power out, but the local officials have done a wonderful job of keeping people safe and getting the power back on and the telephones restored, although I still can't call out long distance on my phone. Thank you for calling me.
Well, I'm not quite sure how that works sometimes, but every once in a while, these little technological miracles. So things, obviously, a hurricane is no joke, even a less powerful one, but it looks like Columbus and your area survived, all right?
That's correct. Yeah, we are, I think we're in good shape, and the people up here in North Mississippi are anxious to reach family members. We're still trying to get in contact with my wife's grandmother and two great aunts and a great uncle who all stayed in Biloxi,
mm-hmm.
East View Drive. In fact, if anybody out there knows India Felsher or Floyd Bennett, please give me a call, as we'd love to know that they're okay.
We've been getting a number of calls from listeners wanting information about their relatives, what to do. All we can do is repeat the advice we got earlier from Lee Stokes of the Mississippi Emergency Management Agency, and that's to call the Red Cross.
Right.
So, Chuck Yarbrough, thanks very much. We appreciate your time today, and congratulations on finding your parents.
Well, thank you so much.
Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
And stay tuned to NPR News for continuing coverage of Hurricane, now Tropical Storm Katrina, the damage along the Gulf Coast, and continuing effects as the storm moves up into the Tennessee and Ohio valleys. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.